ID, the future. A podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Hello again, Tom Gilson here. Today, we're pleased to bring you the second half of a December 2021 webinar spotlighting the recent intelligent design book, Animal Algorithms, Evolution and the Mysterious Origin of Ingenious Instincts. The webinar features scientist Casey Luskin interviewing the book's author, Eric Castle, an expert in navigation and navigation algorithms, with degrees in biology, engineering, and the intersection of science and religion. Here in part two, the conversation pivots to some of the animal kingdom's master architects, and then Castle fields some great questions from the live audience.
You also talk about spider webs in your book, and they're probably one of the most famous examples of an amazing animal behavior. So I want to ask you, Eric, how do spiders produce silk? And what do the theories say about how spiders know instinctively how to produce a web? And are there, again, same question, are there evolutionary explanations for the origin of spider webs? And if so, what do you think of them?
So on the question about silk, what's interesting about that, it's a very complex material that involves a lot of proteins, and it's a very complex process to produce the material. And humans have been trying to duplicate silk artificially for a long time, and basically we've never been able to do it because it's so complex. We have some materials that sort of approximate the composition of silk, but never really duplicates it. So that's one thing there. And the process that the spiders use to generate it is a complex process also. The webs, there has been a lot of research in the web designs and how they possibly could have evolved over time. But there's issues there as well, because, for example, there's species of spiders that are completely unrelated, but yet produce the same exact web design. So how do you explain that? The typical Darwinian explanation that it's convergent evolution, which is just one of these terms that doesn't really have a scientific basis, right? They just use that term to explain something that doesn't fit within typical Darwinian evolution. And it's just, selection pressure or, some other vague term like that is used. But really, the origin of the webs and then how spiders are able to manipulate them, and actually as part of their behavior, the way that they use them is really a complex behavior that's pretty sophisticated.
Yeah, anybody who's seen a spider weaving its web, you have to marvel at that. Even if you believe that it evolved by unguided processes, I think that it's still an amazing thing to watch. So for those of us who are watching this and wondering, okay, so obviously, Eric, we've talked about a few examples of animal behaviors and how they lack evolutionary explanations. But are we ID people the only ones who actually feel this way, that these are a challenge to evolve? I want to note that you provide a really striking quote in your book from Jerry Fedor and Massimo Piattelli Palmarini from their book, What Darwin Got Wrong. And they're talking about animal behavior. And they say in this quote that, quote, such complex, sequential, rigidly pre-programmed behavior could have gone wrong in many ways at any one of its steps. Such cases of elaborate innate behavioral programs, and they say spider webs, bee foraging, as we saw above, and many more, cannot be accounted for by means of optimizing physico, chemical, or geometric factors. And they go on to say that they can hardly be accounted for by gradualistic adaptation either. It's fair to acknowledge that, although we bet some naturalistic explanation will one day be found, we have no such explanation at present. If we insist that natural selection is the only way to try, we will never have one. So, wow. I mean, these are two authors who describe themselves in their book as, quote unquote, outright, card-carrying, signed up, dyed-in-the-wool, no-holds-barred atheists. And yet they're saying that there is no Darwinian natural selection-based explanation, and they're really doubtful there ever will be for the origin of these complex behaviors. And you also talk about a textbook that says, we still know little about the rate and type of evolutionary change experienced by behavioral traits. So, I mean, I guess just to hone in on this point, in all of your readings, have you ever found stepwise, gradualistic, Darwinian evolutionary explanations for the origin of these complex behaviors? Or is this true? I mean, is it really the case that they just don't exist in any detail in the literature?
So, in my research in the literature, for the most part, there isn't any. There's one particular type of behavior that at least there's some theories that have been proposed, and that concerns the insect social behavior. So the basic theory behind that is there are insects, bees, ants, et cetera, that exhibit solitary behaviors. In other words, there's a difference between those that are social and those that are solitary. And so the theory is that when an animal transitions from a solitary lifestyle to a social lifestyle, it's just a matter of adding a few algorithms, if you will, a few steps to integrating that information into a social environment. Well, at first that sounds somewhat plausible, but the evidence really is not there that that's the case, because for two reasons. One is that the social behaviors that these animals exhibit far exceed the behaviors that solitary animals do. That's one thing. The other is the genomic information. Insect social behavior is one area. There has been quite a bit of research into the genomes of these animals. And what's been found is that the genomes of the social insects have undergone significant, and I'm using the word evolution loosely, but significant change when they transition from solitary to social. So there's literally hundreds and thousands of genetic changes that take place in these animals when they're social. So how that could have happened through a step-by-step, piecewise linear Darwinian fashion is not very plausible.
So this will, I think, lead into my final question during our conversational part of the interview, and we'll go to questions from the audience in just a moment here. But I want to ask you, at the end of the day, it sounds like there's a lot of information that goes into the origin of these animal behaviors. So how does information important for the origin of these animal behaviors? And what is your view on what this implies for intelligent design?
Yeah, so, as we've been talking about, these are behaviors, for the most part, are all controlled by algorithms in one form or another. And to have an algorithm, you have to have information. Where does the information come from that even defines the algorithm in the first place? So that's the part that's challenging. A lot of the research that's been done by the ID community tends to indicate that you really can't generate information through a basically a random process, which is, mutations and natural selection. It's just incapable of doing that. And if you look at the work of Bill Dembski and some others regarding these theorems called no free lunch theorems, that's basically what they say. It's difficult to explain the origin of this kind of information through a purely random process. And so I think that's one of the biggest hurdles to overcome in trying to explain the origin of these kinds of behaviors.
Okay, great. Well, let's transition then into some questions from our participants. We have a first question from Jim, who has asked, have there been any attempts to find the location of behavior algorithm in the DNA of a creature? So can they actually pinpoint, the gene or the place in the genome where these algorithms are encoded in your knowledge?
Not that I'm aware of. The only thing I will say is that there has been some research into some fairly simple behaviors where they can explain that there's a basically, for example, a genetic switch. So there's a gene or maybe a couple of genes that control a switch that in turn controls a behavior. So that, but that's a very simple instantiation, and I wouldn't even call it an algorithm. It's just basically on or off kind of a change.
Yeah, so you mentioned that they had mapped the brain of C. elegans, and there's another question that asks, have any specific mutations in C. elegans been mapped or correlated with specific C. elegans behaviors? Are you aware of, have they been able to tease any of that apart?
Yeah, I'm not aware of any research into that.
Okay. What about pheromones? We have a question from Robert. Do animals use pheromones as a component of their navigation?
Yes. So pheromones, there's a couple of different ways that chemicals are used by these animals. One is for chemotaxis, so they will, you know, some animals lay down a trail. For example, ants can lay down a trail with chemicals to follow. But pheromones are also very important in the social insects because what they'll do in the colonies is that they can sense the condition of the colony, various aspects of it, and based on the pheromones that are being output from other insects in the colony. And then in turn, they use that information to change their own behavior. So pheromones are very important.
Hmm. So we have a question from Pat. Can these neural networks be manipulated to deprogram a behavior? So for example, have you ever found a pointless behavior that has been or has a novel, a pointless behavior been programmed by manipulating neurons? So can we basically create new behaviors or remove behaviors through genetic engineering, I suppose?
I would assume the answer is probably yes, but I'm not aware of it. Research into that one.
So here's an interesting question from James. He asks, are such things as goals, intentions, or complementary intuitions really accountable through genetic algorithms? And I think you talk about this a little bit in your book, Eric, basically biologists talking about whether purpose is real or teleology is real in biology, and them not wanting to see teleology, and yet they're confronted with these behaviors that seem to be very, very goal-directed. I mean, even if they evolved, it's very goal-directed, where you have an Arctic tern that's flying from the Arctic to the Antarctic every year. That's very goal-oriented. It has to get to a certain destination. So I guess are these goals real, or are we just imagining that there are goals there?
Well, I think from a common sense point of view, they're real. To me, they're pretty obvious that, for example, navigation and migration, the goal in migration is fairly obvious. And then another example is the social behavior of insects. There's a higher level goal, right? You could actually think of it as different levels. So the higher level goal for a social colony is just for the colony to continue to exist. And in order to do that, there's a number of tasks that have to be performed by the insects in that colony. So, and those are all very purposeful and goal-oriented. But like you said, a lot of scientists have, for a long time now, have tried to avoid even talking about goals and teleology. I use the phrase teleophobia. I think a lot of these scientists are teleophobic about even talking about it.
That's a great word. I'm gonna borrow that word. I'll try to remember to give you credit for that, Eric. And I see this so much in the literature. You see papers actually being written saying, we cannot talk in biology about systems having goals. The goal of a bacterial flagellum is not to help a bacteria swim to find food, okay? There are no goals. It's all unguided. And it really kind of gives them cognitive dissonance trying to understand how these highly goal-directed behaviors and systems don't actually have any purpose. In fact, you make this great point, which I thought was really kind of cute. You said that it seems like the only instinct that exists in the there's one biologist or a evolutionary psychologist who said that human beings have this tendency to view the natural world and all of its wonders through the lens of its design, and that's hindered our understanding of biological complexity. And it seems like, I think you say that the only instinct that actually exists is the human instinct to mistakenly think that instincts are really designed for a purpose. And I just thought, you know, wow. I mean, it's just absurd when you refuse to believe that there's any goal or purpose or design in biology, you really struggle to understand what's going on. Okay, well, we have a question from John talking about the bar-tailed godwit. I don't know if you're familiar with this bird, that it was found to make a world record of flying 7,500 miles nonstop from Alaska to New Zealand, out of sight of land, flying day and night for about 8 days. Wow. Any comments? Are you familiar with this example, or anything you can share about this?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's an amazing, again, amazing feat of navigation that these birds are able to do this. And I'll comment on two aspects of this. One is the fact that they can even sustain themselves for such a period of time, you know, outputting so many calories it takes to fly. You know, one of the things that these long distance migrants do is they basically build up their fat reserves for weeks prior to leaving on migration. So they have the energy reserves. The other thing, and you touched on this earlier about navigation, birds like that, many of them that do these long distance migrations, they're actually flying what we call great circle routes. For those who are not familiar with that, if you think of it, to me, a simple example is if you're going to fly from New York to Tokyo, they're roughly on the same latitude. So if you just looked at a flat map, you would say you just fly due west. Well, that's not the shortest route. When you look at it on a globe, you want to fly basically near or over the North Pole. That's the shortest route from New York to Tokyo. Well, birds, many of these long-distance migrant birds are able to do the same thing. So they have some method that they're actually able to compute these great circle routes. And when we do it, you have to use spherical geometry. How they do it, we have no idea.
Amazing. I want to get back to something you mentioned earlier, Eric, about eusociality and these insects that have complex behaviors that seem designed to benefit the whole hive or population or group. And you also mentioned convergent evolution. So in one of your chapters, I think it might be chapter 5, you talk about how eusociality is found in a number of different insect groups, but they're not necessarily closely related to each other. They're not nested in sort of a nice, neat monophyletic group, these eusocial insects. And in chapter 6, you talk a lot about how animal traits show convergence. So I'm wondering, what in your mind is one of the most striking examples of convergence in animal behaviors that you have encountered in your studies? And do you see this sort of non-monophyletic distribution of eusociality and other complex behaviors, do you see this as posing a challenge not just to Darwinian evolution, but also to common ancestry?
Yeah, exactly. And I think the example you cited and some of these eusocial insects, again, they are the ones that exhibit these behaviors in these very large social colonies. Most of them are completely unrelated phylogenetically. So that means that this behavior developed somehow completely independently in several different animal groups. And then they have the same kinds of behaviors in terms of the social behaviors and the way that the colonies function. And then the other one I would cite is navigation, where a lot of different animals that are completely unrelated use similar kinds of navigation methods. And so there's, again, there's a question there about how could that have happened a number of times completely independently.
Okay, very, very interesting. Yeah, I mean, if it can evolve once, can it keep evolving? But then, you know, this is not how common ancestry would expect us to see these things distributing among organisms where they're not shared by a common ancestor. So here's sort of a philosophical question for you, Eric. It's really an interesting one, but you are treating animal behavior is algorithmic. Tom is asking, I wonder whether our thinking of animals as algorithmic is a way of thinking that Descartes spoke of long ago. Does this thought process get rid of the possibility that animals have free will? What about human beings? So any thoughts on these big picture questions? If animals are just programmed, is there such a thing as free will in these animals?
Wow, that's a good question. what I would say is that in the types of animals that are discussed in the book, these animals are they're not really that intelligent. In other words, they're not intelligent in the sense that we think of humans, other mammals, where we're able to think and have some form of free will. These animals, basically, all of their behaviors are programmed in one way or another. And whenever they are faced with a certain circumstance, they're going to behave in a pre-programmed type of way. Now, they do learn. Many of them do learn to some extent, but the basic behaviors there are really pre-programmed.
Yeah, I don't think anybody's going to get too worked up if it turns out that ants don't have free will, or it turns out that, you know, a spider is just acting on instinct when it spins a web. On the other hand, you know, those of us who've had like pet birds, I had a pet bird growing up, that bird, it was very interactive. I mean, I had a friendship with this little pet parakeet when I was 8 years old. And so we'd like to think that some of these animals maybe do have some human-like ability to relate, free will, whatever you want to call it. I don't know. I mean, these are very complicated questions. We have a question from Jeff Simmons, who is a Discovery Institute fellow. And this is a question that actually I've wondered about for many years, Eric, because of my interest in paleomagnetism and the Earth's magnetic field, and also plate tectonics. And the question is, magnetic poles can shift. You know, we can have suddenly north become south and south becomes north. Continents can drift. And so can these animal behaviors accommodate changes in Earth's magnetic field or Earth's geography in order to allow animals to continue to migrate? So, and let me maybe put a little bit extra on this question. Geomagnetic reversal, when the Earth's magnetic field flips, is thought to occur potentially in less than 1,000 years. It might even be 500 years or less. We don't know for sure, but it could be a very short period of time. So can Darwinian evolution keep up with those kinds of shifts so that you don't have geese migrating north for the winter instead of south and then freezing to death, you know? Or is it possible that animals are actually pre-programmed to be able to adapt quickly to these magnetic reversals, which have happened many times throughout Earth's history? Any speculations or thoughts on this? Have you thought about this at all? Any thoughts you might have?
Yeah, that's one of the things that I've thought about a lot, is trying to figure out how could animals adapt to that. Like you say, that these pole reversals happen in a relatively short period of time. So a group of animals that migrate and depend on sensing the magnetic polarity, how do they adapt to that? I don't know. It's hard. So first thing would be, well, typical Darwinian evolution is too slow to adapt that quickly to something like that, you would think. So maybe there's some other mechanism, some kind of an epigenetic mechanism that's involved that allows an adaptation. We really don't know, but it's a great question.
Yeah, it is a really great question. I think you're right. I think that Darwinian evolution moves very slowly, and it's difficult to imagine it being able to keep up, because obviously if you get the migration wrong, you might not be able to survive. If you're migrating north for the winter, you're going to freeze to death. Or if you can't find that island out in the ocean where you want to go back and spawn and reproduce, you're not going to be able to leave offspring. So these are pretty important things. So I'm wondering, there's a question from Craig. Have you looked at all at the engineering basis for what systems are used by the hummingbird when it migrates with the seasons. And do you know anything about hummingbird migration and the integration of the systems in that organism?
No, sorry. I'm not that familiar with the hummingbird migrations.
Okay, that's fine. Robert asked the question, do you use the term instinct? He says, I never liked that term because it seemed like a placeholder for ignorance. So is instinct a real thing, or is an instinct just a program behavior? Are you maybe giving us a new paradigm for understanding what an instinct is as an algorithmic program behavior?
Well, that's an interesting question, because in researching the book, what I realized that within the scientific community, particularly the animal behaviorists, they had kind of moved away from the word instinct to describe behaviors such as this. They really don't like that term. But basically they've used other terms that are functionally equivalent, such as innate or pre-programmed. And it really, to me, you could use several different terms which really mean the same thing, that it's a behavior that does not require any learning. The animal exhibits the behavior almost from the moment it's born. And you can use whatever term you want to describe that. But in previously, people would have called that instinct.
Mm. So we have a question from Michaela, who says, do you see this becoming a growing field of research in the future? And I want to add to this a little bit. I helped to direct the ID 3.0 research program here at Discovery Institute. And one of the exciting things, one of the points of the ID 3.0 research program, is to see ID research breaking into new fields that it's never gone into before: population genetics, biomedicine therapies, all kinds of different new fields. So I think a field of animal behavior would be a wonderful field for ID to be able to break into. So do you see this becoming a field of ID research in the future? And if so, do you have any words of wisdom you could give people who are interested in animal behavior and want to try to apply ID to understanding animal behavior?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm, one of the things I'm hoping for that might come out of this is, because I've really just kind of scratched the surface. And it's basically just by reviewing the literature that's out there. There is a lot of research that has been done in a number of these types of behaviors, but obviously not from an ID perspective. And there's a lot of more research that could be done to try to assess and, you know, determine where these behaviors come from, how they develop, what controls them. And in particular, another aspect of it that we kind of touched on a little bit is, how do these behaviors actually get programmed into the brain in some way? There's an area of neuroscience here that is ripe for a lot of research. And so that's what I'm hoping, that there'll be ideas for new research to get into.
Well, great. Well, I think that's a great place to end this webinar, Eric. Thank you so much, Eric Castle, for your book, Animal Algorithms. I hope that it's inspiring to people who want to pursue ID research in this area of animal behavior. And I also want to mention that if you have bought the book, we would really appreciate it if you would go and review it on Amazon. It's always helpful to have people be able to hear your thoughts about these books, share your insights, share your inspiration from Eric Castle. So Eric, thank you so much for the work you've done and for helping us to learn so much about animal algorithms, and for opening up a new field, I think, of ID research here.
Thanks, Casey. I appreciate it. I really enjoyed this.
Okay. Well, thanks also for the participants who have come and engaged with us today. Some great questions and a great conversation. This was a lot of fun. I'm Casey Luskin, and please stay tuned. Hopefully, we'll do this again.
Hi, this is Steve Meyer, and I want to thank you for being a regular listener of the ID the Future podcast. We appreciate your interest in intelligent design and the work we're doing to develop the case for the theory of intelligent design. And I'd like to encourage you, if you find these broadcasts edifying, intellectually or otherwise, to become a regular financial supporter of the work of the Center for Science and Culture. You may know that we depend entirely on private donations. We don't get any federal money. We don't get government money for our scientific research program. And if you find the work that we're doing interesting, we'd be awfully grateful if you'd consider becoming a partner in that work by providing whatever you're able to ensure that that work goes forward.
To give, go to discovery.org/ID/donate. That's discovery.org/ID/donate. Thanks so much.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by its Center for Science and Culture.